You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Writing in his seminal work, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money in 1936, John Maynard Keynes observed that the ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back, he said. Now, in the continuing debate about how to end poverty and build prosperity in South Africa, ideologues in the ruling party have put forward powerfully seductive, often conflicting, and often ultimately destructive ideas. And these ideas have been thrust into the public arena. Things like cadre deployment, central planning, master plans, the current favourite of the Trade, Industry and Competition Minister Ibrahim Patel, and the developmental state, just to name but a few. And the stagnant economy should be proof of these ideas and their toxicity to the economy having failed. But instead, often we just see the ruling party lean on its hold of the levers of state power to double down. The battle of ideas is a phrase that I will long associate with the Institute of Race Relations under the leadership of Franz Kronier, who announced his retirement as CEO of the Institute last week to be phased in over the course of the year. Kronier was educated at St. John's College in Houghton. He holds a PhD in scenario planning, and he's published three books on South Africa's future and authored scores of policy assessments and briefings and reports and forecasts on the country. His third book, The Rise or Fall of South Africa, was published in April last year, and he directs the Centre for Risk Analysis, which is a Joburg-based strategic intelligence think tank that has advised a number of corporations and government agencies around the world on South Africa's long-term economic, social, political and policy trends. And he teaches scenario-based strategy at a South African business school from time to time. Franz, a busy man. Welcome to the show. You've been at the Institute now for 18 years, eight as CEO. And I recall David Gleeson always relaying the story about former Anglo CEO Gavin Reilly, telling him that a CEO's ideal tenure is around 7 years before you need fresh eyes and ideas. And you decided, obviously, to stay on and see the Institute through COVID. So after 8 years, probably the right call to inject a fresh pair of eyes and ideas. But you are staying till the end of the year to oversee the transition. Let's just look in the rearview mirror before we talk about the challenges that the new CEO will encounter in South Africa. How has the work of the Institute had to evolve from your roots as this libertarian think tank fighting apartheid to one now providing a check on unfettered power under a hegemonic ANC at the polls, at least?
Hi, Michael. It's good to be on with you. I don't think we're libertarian. There's a libertarian fringe, of course, but we're a classically liberal group. And that is a spectrum of ideas, and we're not dogmatic. So we're tolerant of our libertarian fringe. And how's it evolved? Well, it hasn't really changed. It didn't change during my tenure, and it hasn't really changed since the late 1920s when the organization was established. And it still practices the same thing, later put so well by Margaret Thatcher, that if you want to win the politics, you first got to win the argument. And that remains South Africa's problem. And I think the sort of abiding memory for me of my tenure is the number of people who knocked on the door, frustrated at the country's politics, and increasingly so over time, now more so than ever. And who said, why doesn't it work? As sometimes they had contributed significantly to that politics, they'd financed it. And our argument was always the same, that the policies in any society reflect its dominant ideas. And until you're able to shape and influence the dominant ideas, you're not going to get anywhere with policy, and you're not going to get anywhere with politics. And the work of the IRR has always been and remains exactly that. We want to shape public opinion. We want to shape the ideas people have. In free societies, public policy follows public opinion really quickly. Even in closed societies, dictatorial ones, fascist dictatorships, in time, public opinion prevails and shapes the direction of that society. That inspired the fight against apartheid until its core tenet of separate development was wholly discredited. The reforms that later occurred were impossible. And the same thing happens in South Africa today. And to distill it to its essence, until we supplant the idea of redistribution and redress as a way to create a successful and prosperous society with the idea that investment-led growth, expansion of economic opportunities is the only way to do it, I'm afraid we're set to continue facing a political system and a policy framework that can't get South Africa out of the hole that it's in. Michael.
France and some we know have tried to characterize the Institute as right-wing because of those ideals, because you are advocating for something that is so out of lockstep with the hegemonic thought that has been created by the ruling party's idea of what transformation must look like. And we see it today with the announcement of a new fund. The National Empowerment Fund is setting up a fund to support only black-owned and managed businesses who have suffered because of COVID-19 in a country where all businesses have suffered. How do these attacks land inside the Institute? Because one looks at them and one finds it so strange that an Institute talking about the sanctity of the individual and the right to own property would be characterized as right-wing.
Yeah, look, it comes with the territory, of course, and it's been a part and parcel of the organization through its history. I mean, but before this era, must remember that there was a time when the Institute was a front for the Soviet Union, attempting to bring communism to South Africa by advocating for the very same ideas and principles. In my time, it's been put to me that I'm a front for everything from Inkatha to the DA, the ANC, and the CIA. So it comes with the territory. The advantage of the organization is that it is wholly independent. It doesn't have any single source of revenue or support that can sway it in a particular direction. And so we the slings and arrows are always there. They do damage, there's no doubt of that. They do sway opinion in the short term. But in the long term, you've got to be judged on your track record. And you've got to be judged on something related to that track record, is what were you talking about? Was it bias in favor of a particular personality, institution, or party? Or was there always running through all the commentary, all the writing, all the advocacy? Was there one set of dominant ideas? And on that, you build your reputation. So the short-term attacks, they come out of various quarters. They part and parcel of the thing. If you're not having an effect, you're not going to come under pressure. Natan Sharansky put it so well. He said that the idea of a closed society is to narrowly define what is seen as acceptable debate and then encourage very vigorous debate within those narrow confines. So in South Africa, for example, you can debate empowerment policy, but you can only do it in one way: how to make current race-based policy work better. We broke those constraints and we said, well, we want to debate empowerment policy on a different level. We want to debate whether there's a policy that will be better than the narrow race-based approach in order to accelerate millions of people into the middle classes where they can be very successful. And that politically is lethal to do. You want to keep people thinking within the narrow confines of debate. So yeah, it was as ridiculous as saying we've got a better way to lift people out of poverty than the current approach of the government, and have that thrown at you as an example of a right wing or left wing or whatever wing it was on. You do lose a touch in the end. But I'm very happy that if you read the history of the organization over time, I mean, other people must judge my role in that. I can't do that. I think that common theme runs to free people in order that they might think for themselves, be highly educated, and see their lives improved through their own very hard efforts, hard work, leveraged against expert education, so that they can accumulate wealth and assets and lift our whole society. And I don't think there's really anyone around who's serious about South Africans' future who would have any argument that that is exactly what this country still needs.
And running an organisation like yours, obviously donor funding is critical for the continued health and sustainability of think tanks, or is it about a new model? Because what we are seeing is that the role that you play in being a key check and balance on unfettered state power and taking these decisions to go against the popular narrative has meant that certain funders just find it difficult politically to continue funding you. And you have countered in the past the Anglo-American Chairman's Fund, the Elizabeth Bradley Trust, the Frederick Naaman Foundation for Freedom, great foundations among some of your key funders. But as you said, you know, when you started speaking truth as you saw it to power around things like BEE, many of those funders became uncomfortable. It's important to understand and grapple with these issues in the context of the role that think tanks and non-profits play in South Africa, France. How do you see the model playing itself out in the future?
Yeah, I got views on that. 20 years ago, roughly, three quarters of the funding of the group that I lead would have fallen into that broad category, I suppose, of donor funding. Today, that figure, depends how you define it, probably sitting at around 10% or less. And it was a very important part of the long history of the organization. In fact, had it not been for the forward thinking of the Oppenheimers, of the family itself, of the executives at Anglo American, the Institute would have had a very tough time during apartheid. They were big and tough enough that their support was very useful in helping us to stand up to the efforts of the Nats to undermine the Institute. Over time, that began to change. I think that social media played a role in that. I think that a crippling tide of political correctness has swept across the free world, and South Africa is very much part of that free world. And we saw the sort of long-term thinking of broader donor communities change. We were early on this. We could see where it was going. And we realized that if you remain dependent on the financing of a few very influential and very wealthy groups, they will themselves come under pressure, and they will place pressure on you to shift your agenda. I said at an internal staff meeting on a new think tank we're launching this morning that one of the things I've been very good at is showing donors the door, but that you mustn't do too much of that. But I think donors have a role, and they have an important role, but only where that organization that contributes funds is absolutely happy with the type of work done by the institution in question. Into the longer term, I don't see donors being part of independent think tanks in the free world to any significant extent. They're too easily swayed by short-term considerations, but they're fantastic models available to think tanks. We've been very successful in them. One is user pays approach. If you find the ideas useful, if you use them inside your organization, we're not a charity, we're a non-profit organization. You know, if you want the advice, put on the money. And then we'll talk to you and we'll show you how we see society. That worked very, very well for the organization. Mm. Crowd financing is immensely powerful. It's not just activist groups who hold protest marches and the like. We've pioneered it amongst think tanks. It's been a spectacular success for us. It's allowed us to grow and expand very quickly. And now and again, when I'm asked to talk on these kind of think tank platforms around the world, about what the model is and how to deal with the sort of political correctness tide sweeping the free world, my advice in the main is if you want to make it on your own two feet and make sure your products, the work you do, the impact you have is of sufficient quality that the public has an incentive in supporting you. Then you'll be truly independent. If you adopt that mindset in running think tanks, I think the organization that you run can be hugely successful over the next 10 or 20 years, even in an environment where traditionally classically liberal ideas about property rights, about free speech, about market economics, even in the Western world, become increasingly unpopular, you can stand out as an organization, do really well.
And Fred, you have done that very well. Looking at your Facebook page this morning, you had over 100,000 subscribers or likes or whatever the metric is on Facebook. You've got a very successful go-to-market in the Daily Friend. You've done a lot of this now. And just before we go to break, how do you guard against confirmation bias or in an environment where you are delivering something that is now going to be consumed by a larger portion of the population on a user pays type model to ensure that you don't go down the route of something that is slightly more populist and loses its intellectual rigor?
Yeah, the pressure's all the time. You don't want the tail to wag the dog on these things. Two ways you get around that. One, it's rock solid in the organization what you stand for, what you believe, and there are no internal contradictions. And being part of an aged organization with very well established roots of ideas of what it believes in and why, that was very useful. In our own case, we have a unique management model. We have a management team that I lead. I report to the board, and the board runs the business of the place. Has all the fiduciary duties, but we have what is in effect a Politburo above us. And the Politburo is the sort of supreme being within the organization. And its purpose is in the main to ensure that we stay on the classically liberal straight and narrow, regardless of the financial or economic consequences. And hence the backing I had to show donors the door where they became, where a point was reached where they were trying to dictate the agenda to us. So if your ideas are right, your structure's right, you will not have that problem. And ultimately, Michael, you can't fool people. If you want to be a long-term proposition with broad public support, you've got to drive ideas that resonate with moderate middle of public opinion, because that is the moderate middle of almost every society. They're not as fragmented as politics makes it seem. And you've got to be honest with the chap who puts in his 100 grand a month to back you. Because if you become populist or you take shortcuts or anything of that nature or try and push some narrow political agenda, that guy will be onto you pretty quickly. Before you know it, he'll have dropped you. So there are many safeguards in place. They're important. But my experience is, as we pioneered this new model, that it worked pretty well.
Turning now to where South Africa finds itself, one of the central campaigns that you have been running and have been consistent about really is to highlight the ANC's National Democratic Revolution, the NDR, as being a direct threat to democracy and to constitutionalism. Just share, before we speak about things like EWC and the expropriation bill, why and how this NDR is incongruous with a constitutional democracy.
Yeah, well, you know the story because you see it on your show a lot and you see it across the media. The question why does the government do something that to many people, particularly in business, seems counterproductive? And that question pops up a lot. It's probably the one question that's put to me more than anything else over my tenure at the Institute. And it's put to me by corporations, put to me by capitalists, put to me by executives, put to me by Western diplomats, never been put to me by the Chinese or by Chinese firms and institutions. And the reason for that, and this is the critical, if you feel you've been kind of caught off guard time and time again by South Africa, that you kind of expect something and then quite the opposite happens and it's totally counterproductive, I will guess that the reason is that you never developed a profound enough understanding of the implications of the dominant ideology of the South African government. Dominant ideas inform policies. They're incredibly powerful. And because top executives are successful, they have a difficulty in understanding this. Because if you're a leader of a successful firm, it means that wherever you confronted an obstacle or a challenge, you very quickly adjusted strategy or idea, implemented something new, and you survived. That's why you're still in business. Politics works very differently. And deep within the ANC, a function of two things. Firstly, it's being hounded into the arms of the Soviets and the East Germans in the 1950s. And secondly, the fact that the pragmatists in the ANC were defeated at Polokwane in 2007. The dominant basis of ideas within that party that inform many of its policies is a set of ideas, we call them the National Democratic Revolution, that the way you create a decent society, a prosperous society, a happy one, is you put the state in a position where it can direct economic activity and resources within that society. Only if you achieve that can you truly liberate the poor. Now, policies from EWC through to national health insurance, through to these subsidies that Minister Patel is so keen on these days, reflect that dominant idea. And unless you're willing to accept and to demonstrate the requisite respect to the ANC, in fact, to understand what drives its thinking, this to you seems peculiar. It seems counterproductive. It makes no sense, as Western diplomats say when they're fresh off the boat here. They'll say to us, they look at South Africa, its potential, its policies. They say it's nonsensical what you're doing. I said to them, it's not nonsensical. You've just got to, you can't insist on seeing the world through a prism and frame of reference that you are comfortable with. You've actually got to get out of that frame of reference and understand why this makes sense to the South African government. If you don't do that, you can't address the root of the problem. If you can't address the root of the problem, you can't win the argument. Therefore, you can't win the politics. And therefore, you're sort of doomed to go through this kind of Groundhog Day South Africa thing of reforms that never take off. So we stressed that because it is the beginning of understanding the problem. And if you try and understand the problem at a point beyond that, without proper reflection on its ideological origins, you're never going to get anywhere. So it was the central feature of our work. It has been that on whichever government has run South Africa for decades and decades. And if you understand it and address it and turn it into its, what's its antithesis? The antithesis is the idea that the state should create the circumstances to liberate the individual, to liberate innovation, to free people to take the steps towards improving their own lives. That's not libertarianism, because I said the state's got to create those circumstances. It's a very important role for a government to have. Of that, there's no doubt at all, and it's got to do that. But unless the dominant idea in South Africa shifts from the NDR approach, state-directed command economy development, across a brand new model that sees the state create circumstances where people, businesses, investors, entrepreneurs, capitalists even, are able to drive economic rebuilding, we're doomed to remain a country with a pretty high unemployment rate, pretty deep deficit, and pretty uncompetitive investment levels compared to our emerging market peers.
It's such an important ideological route, the ontology to understand the NDR. You mentioned an important point though, 2007, where the pragmatists were defeated. What everyone expected within corporate South Africa, at least, which was really the tailwind of Ramaphosa, was that the pragmatists had now won again, or the pragmatists that were defeated in 2007 had now won back that middle ground inside the ruling party. And so everyone was hopeful and looking for these reforms, for the state to now create those conditions within which the private sector can thrive and flourish. And while we've seen little pieces of it in the SONA, I don't think I've ever seen the private sector mentioned as much as it was. We're still sitting here waiting for a single new megawatt to be procured. We still see lots of issues in mining around the MPRDA. We still see all of these bills. We still see a trade and industry minister wedded to these ideas of tariffs. Why is it that the reformists, or this whole reformist narrative, is not reforming the ANC from within? Is it all down to the NDR?
Well, I think there are two analytical mistakes that I saw people make. One is the assumption that reformers won, and they didn't. The reformist movement that there was owes its origins to Mandela's early moves in the 90s, and particularly a speech at Davos that was very important. They were roundly defeated in 2007. And what reformers there were crushed, is the way I describe it to a client, between the two now dominant factions. One is the state capture faction of old, terribly corrupt. And the second dominant faction is an ideologically quite radical left-wing faction that believes the state should direct the economy. Between them, there's nothing, very little left. I mean, we've done some recent estimates on the cabinet, and they're almost too sad to put to you. We think about 3% of the cabinet, if we put it in percentage terms, we don't like talking about the people and their names, are really open to the kinds of reform South Africa needs to be successful. So you don't have reform in South Africa, the why question, because you don't have reformers. You can't have the one without the other. And you don't have reformers because the dominant ideas of the government of the day and its party are hostile to reform. These things all are logical. Second analytical mistake is that there is a reformist narrative. What is that reformist narrative? We haven't seen it because there's talk we must have growth. Good. We must have more jobs. That's also good. We must have we must have more investment. That's also fine. That's not a reformist narrative. That's a list of aspirations. But between those aspirations and the actual policies of the government, in terms of the cost of employing someone, the cost of labor market policy, or the extent to which empowerment policy is seen as a tax on investment, or the assault on property rights, which any intelligent person with real money invested in South Africa knows is not a land reform policy. The policies in place to reach the aspirations are in fact at odds with the aspirations. So there is no reformist narrative. And saying I want higher levels of growth is not a reformist narrative. Reformist narrative is a policy document, a SONA speech, a speech delivered by the minister that says we have taken the firm decision to change direction, and therefore we are repealing X, introducing Y. There is no such narrative in South Africa, and there can't be because they're not any reformers in great bulk. They're not any reformers because the dominant ideas of the government of the day are opposed to reform. Now, don't let this depress you too much. Develop a proper understanding of time and realize that this is greatly frustrating to the people who live in the country. We see that in polling, in voter, in data, in protest action. And the reason we became a democracy, Michael, 25 years ago, is that if we reach a point where, for reasons of dogma, the government of the day cannot introduce policies that meet the aspirations of its people, there'd be a political realignment. And our big long-term call for South Africa's next decade is that the country is standing on the brink of a realignment now, on a scale of what it last saw in the 1980s and 1990s. And therefore, if you've got some risk appetite and some long-term understanding, you could even take the state of the country today and from it and its trends draw the conclusion that we're actually standing at quite an important moment, and perhaps one that offers a way out through the ballot box, and therefore that the future might be looking a lot better out into the next 10 to 15 years than it has been over the past 10 to 15 years. So that takes care of the idea thrown at me that we're not optimistic about the future. We're actually, in the longer scheme, produce some of the most upbeat assessments about where South Africa can go next.
We just have to reimagine South Africa, to your earlier point, through this realignment of political forces and a true reform agenda. Franz, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm going to have you back on because there's just so much more to talk about. I believe the Institute is working on some fascinating research around the US dollar, but we're going to have to leave it there. As I said, we have run out of time. Franz Cronier, the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, still for this year, talking about the role of the National Democratic Revolution still, and the fact that, in effect, there are no reformers inside the ruling party.